Charlie was a man who occupied the same space as her father, embodied the same archetype, the strong, silent loner, the good man. But it was a mirage. The truth was, Charlie was nothing like her father. With him, the good guy thing was just an act. Where her father was confident, Charlie was arrogant. Where her father was chivalrous, Charlie was patronizing and smug. He had wooed her, seduced her with empathy and warmth, and then, out of nowhere, he turned into Mr. Hyde, berating her in public, telling her she was stupid, she was fat, she was a slut. At first, she treated this change as if it were her fault. Clearly, he was reacting to something. Maybe she had put on a few pounds. Maybe she had been flirting with that Saudi prince. But then, as his behavior intensified, culminating in a terrifying bedroom choking, she realized that Charlie was crazy. All of his jealousy and viciousness was the bad side of his bipolar heart. He wasn't a good man. He was a natural disaster. And so Emma did what any sane person does in the face of a natural disaster. She ran. Now she dresses quickly, pulling on her least flattering outfit. She wipes the makeup from her cheeks with a towel, takes out her contact lenses, putting on the cat's eye glasses she bought in Brooklyn. Her first instinct is to say she feels sick and stay home, but she knows what Charlie will do. He'll offer to stay and take care of her, and the last thing Emma can handle is being alone with him. Someone bangs on the bedroom door, making Emma jump.
"Come on, whore!"
yells Chelsea.
"Farhad's waiting!"
Emma grabs her coat. She will stay close to the others, sticking to Chelsea and Carver, latching on to the pretty Spaniard. She will stick to them like glue, and then, when the time is right, she will slip away. She will come back to the apartment, grab her things, and check into a hotel under an assumed name. And if he tries anything, she will call the company tomorrow and file a formal complaint.
"Coming!"
she yells, hurriedly packing. She will put her suitcase by the door and be gone before anyone's the wiser. 10 seconds, in and out. She can do this. She wanted to change her life anyway. This is her chance. And as she opens the door, she finds that her pulse has almost returned to normal. And then she sees Charlie standing by the front door, smiling with his X-ray eyes.
"Okay,"
says Emma.
"I'm ready."
Hurt. Morning traffic, human and vehicular, moves up 6th Avenue in ever-shifting patterns. Each body, car, and bicycle is a water molecule that would travel in a straight line at maximum speed if not for all the other molecules competing for space in an ever-shrinking channel, like an ocean strained through a fire hose. It is a sea of earbuds, bodies moving to their own beat. Working women in sneakers text on the go, their minds 1,000 miles away. Cab drivers half watching the road and half scrolling through messages from faraway lands. Doug stands outside the entrance to the ALC building, smoking a final cigarette. He has slept 3 hours in the last 2 days. A smell test of his beard would yield hints of bourbon, drive-through cheeseburgers, and the peaty curl of Brooklyn lager. His lips are chapped, synapses firing too fast and in too many directions. He is a revenge machine, one that has convinced itself that truth is subjective, and that a man wronged has the right, no, the moral duty, to set the record straight. Krista Brewer, Bill Cunningham's producer, meets him in the lobby, moving at a near run. She actually pushes a black guy with a messenger bag out of the way, her eyes locked on Doug's shuffling form.
"Doug, hi,"
she says, smiling like a hostage negotiator who's been taught not to break eye contact.
"Krista Brewer, we spoke on the phone."
"Where's Bill?" Doug asks nervously, having second thoughts. He had a vision of how this would go in his head, and this isn't it. She smiles.
"Upstairs. He can't wait to see you."
Doug frowns, but she takes his arm, leads him past security, and onto a waiting elevator. It is the morning rush, and they are packed in with 12 other molecules, all destined for different floors, different lives. 10 minutes later, Doug finds himself in a chair in front of a triple mirror framed in bright lights. A woman with a lot of bracelets brushes his hair and puts foundation on his forehead, dabbing him with powder.
You got plans for the weekend?
She asks him. Doug shakes his head. His wife has just thrown him out of the house. He spent the first 12 hours drunk, and the last 6 sleeping in his pickup truck. He feels like Humphrey Bogart in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, that same sense of crazed loss, so close. Not that it's about the money. It's the principle. Eleanor is his wife, and the kid is their kid. And yes, $103 million plus 40 more for the real estate is a lot of money. And yes, he has already shifted his worldview, luxuriating in the idea that he is now a man of means. And no, he doesn't think that money solves every problem, but certainly it will make their lives easier. He can finish the restaurant, no problem, and finally finish that novel. They can afford child care for the kid and maybe fix up the Croton house for weekends while they move into the townhouse on the Upper East Side. The Bateman's cappuccino machine alone is worth relocating for, and yes, he knows that's shallow, but isn't that what the whole artisanal return to simplicity movement is all about? Making sure that every single thing we do is thoughtful and perfect? That every bite of every meal, every step of every day, everything from our hemp throw pillows to our handcrafted bicycles is like a koan from the Dalai Lama. We are the enemies of industrialization, killers of the mass market. No more 10 billion served. Now, it's one meal at a time. Eggs cooked from your own chickens. Seltzer infused by your own CO2 tank. This is the revolution. Back to the soil, the loom, the still. And yet the struggle is hard. The way each man has to claw his way into some kind of future, to overcome the obstacles of youth and establish himself without getting lost along the way. And the money would help with that. It would remove the worry, the risk, especially now with the kid and how hard that can be. Like, say, if you weren't really ready yet to have that much responsibility, to put your own needs aside for the needs of something small and irrational that can't even wipe its own butt. In the chair, he's starting to sweat. The makeup lady blots his forehead.
Maybe take off your coat, she suggests.
But Doug is thinking about Scott, about the snake in his home. And how this fucking guy just drives up like he owns the place. Like, just because he's got this bond with the kid, he's invited somehow to move in. And what did Doug ever do to deserve being thrown out of his own home? Yeah, okay, he came home drunk after midnight, and maybe he was a little pissed off and yelling, but it's his house, after all, and she's his woman. And what kind of bizarro world are we living in if some has-been painter has more of a right to be in a man's home than he does? So he says all this to Eleanor. Orders her to send the guy packing as soon as the sun comes up. Tells her that she's his wife and he loves her, and they have a beautiful thing. A thing worth protecting, cherishing, especially now that they're parents, right? That he's a father. And Eleanor listens. Just listens. Sits very still. Doesn't get upset. Doesn't seem scared or pissed or anything. She just listens to him rant and stomp around the bedroom, and then, when he runs out of gas, she tells him she wants a divorce and that he should go sleep on the couch. Krista comes back smiling. They're ready for him, she says. Bill is ready, and Doug is so brave for coming in, and the country, the world, is so grateful that there are men like Doug out there who are willing to tell the truth about things, even if it's hard. And Doug nods. This is him in a nutshell. He is the common man, noble, hard-working. A man who doesn't complain or demand, but one who expects the world to be square with him. Who expects a day's work to earn a day's pay. Expects that the life you build, the family you make, is your life, your family. You earned it, and nobody should be able to take that away from you. A lottery won should stay won. So he takes off the paper bib and goes to meet his destiny. Doug, says Bill, thank you for being here today. Doug nods, trying not to look into the camera. Just focus on me, Bill has told him, and this is what he does. Focuses on the other man's eyebrows, the tip of his nose. He's not handsome, Bill Cunningham, not in the traditional sense, but he has that alpha bravado, the indefinable nexus of power, charisma, and confidence, the unblinking gaze and crotch-forward carriage of a man at the height of his visceral global impact. Is it physical? Pheromonal? An aura? For some reason, Doug thinks of the way a school of reef sharks will scatter when a great white appears, the way some woodland deer will simply surrender to the jaws of the wolf, ceasing their struggles and lying still, subdued by inevitable and irresistible forces. And then he thinks, am I the deer? These are troubling times, says Bill. Don't you agree? Doug blinks. Do I agree that the times are troubling? For you. For me. For America. I'm talking about loss and injustice. Doug nods. This is the story he wants to tell. It's a tragedy, he says. We all know it. The crash, and now... Bill leans forward. Their feed is being beamed by satellite to 900 million possible screens worldwide. For people who don't know the story as well as me, he says, give a little background. Doug fidgets nervously, then becomes conscious that he's fidgeting and gives an odd shrug. Well, you know about the crash, the plane crash, and how only two people survived. J.J., my nephew, my, wife's nephew, and this painter, Scott, something, who supposedly swam to shore. Supposedly? No, says Doug, backpedaling. I'm just going off something you... I mean, it was heroic, definitely, but that doesn't... Bill shakes his head imperceptibly. And so you took him in, he says, your nephew. Yes, of course. I mean, he's only four. His parents are dead. Yes, says Bill. You took him in because you're a good man, a man who cares about doing the right thing. Doug nods. We don't have much, you know, says Doug. I'm a writer, and Eleanor, my wife, she's a physical therapist. A caregiver. Right, but, you know, whatever we have is his. He's family, right, JJ? And look, Doug takes a breath, trying to focus on the story he wants to tell. Look, I'm not perfect. Who is? Asks Bill. Plus, how old are you even?
I'm 34.
A baby.
I work hard, okay? I'm trying to start a restaurant, to rebuild, while also, okay, sometimes I have a few beers.
Who doesn't, says Bill, at the end of a long day. In my book, that makes a man a patriot.
Right. And look, the guy's a hero, Scott, clearly, but, well, he kind of moved in.
Scott Burroughs? He moved into your house?
Well, he showed up a couple of days ago to see the kid, which, again, he saved him, right? So that's, nobody's saying he can't see JJ, but a man's home is supposed to be his, and my wife, you know? It's a lot to handle with the boy, a lot to process, so maybe she's just confused, but...
Bill bites his lip. Though he doesn't show the audience at home, he's losing his patience with Doug, who is clearly a basket case and who, left to his own devices, will implode without communicating the story Bill has brought him here to tell. Let me see, he interrupts. Not to interrupt, but let me see if I can clarify a few things here, because, well, you're clearly upset. Doug stops, nods. Bill turns slightly so he's speaking into the camera. Your wife's sister and her husband were killed, along with their daughter, under very suspicious circumstances in a private plane crash, leaving their son JJ an orphan at four. So you and your wife took him in, out of the goodness of your hearts, and have been trying to give him some kind of family, help him through this terrible time. And then another man, Scott Burroughs, a man rumored to have been romantically involved with your sister-in-law, who was last seen leaving the home of a loose and notoriously single heiress, has moved into your house, while you, meanwhile, have been asked to leave by your wife. He turns to Doug. You were thrown out, he says, to call it what it is. Where did you sleep last night?
In my truck, Doug mumbles.
What?
In my truck. I slept in my truck.
Bill shakes his head. You slept in a truck, while Scott Burrows slept in your house, with your wife.
No, I mean, I don't know if there's, that it's something romantic. I'm not...
Son, please. What else would it be? The man saves the boy, allegedly, and your wife takes him in, both of them, as if to make, what, a new family? Who cares that her actual husband is now homeless, heartbroken?
Doug nods, the urge to cry suddenly unstoppable, but he pulls himself together.
Don't forget about the money, he says.
Bill nods. Bingo.
What money?
He says innocently. Doug wipes his eyes, aware that he is slumped over. He straightens, trying to regain control.
So, David and Maggie, JJ's parents, they were... Well, you know, he ran this network. That's not to say anything shady, but, I mean, they were very wealthy people.
Worth what, approximately?
I don't know that I should...
10 million? 50? Doug hesitates. More? Asks Bill.
Maybe double,
says Doug reluctantly.
Wow.
Okay. $100 million. And this money. Doug rubs his beard a few quick times with his hand, like a man trying to sober up.
A lot of it goes to charity, he says. But then, of course, the rest is JJ's, in a trust, which, you know, he's for.
So you're saying, says Bill, I think you're saying, that whoever gets the boy gets the money.
That's, I mean, a coarse way of...
Bill stares at him with disdain. I prefer the word blunt. My point is, and maybe I'm being dumb here, but there are tens of millions of dollars at stake for whoever parents this kid. My godchild, I should add. So yeah, I'm not, in the spirit of full transparency, I'm not objective here by a long shot. And what he's been through, the death of his... Everybody he loves. That this kid would become a pawn.
Well, I mean, Eleanor's not... She's a good person. Means well. I just... My thought is, she must be... It's manipulation somehow.
By the painter.
Or, I don't know, maybe the money made her... The idea of it changed her somehow.
Because you thought you had a happy marriage.
Well, I mean, there's some struggle, right? We don't always, but that's, in your 20s, 30s, it's hard work, life, making your mark, and you're supposed to stick by each other, not...
Bill nods, sits back. In his right pant pocket, his phone vibrates. He slips it out and looks at the text message, his eyes narrowing. As he does, a second message comes in, then a third.
Namor has been bugging the wife's home phone and is writing to say he heard something.
Calls between swimmer and heiress last night. Sexy stuff. And then, also swimmer and NTSB. Flight recorder damaged. Followed by, swimmer admits betting heiress.
Bill pockets his phone. Pulls himself up to his full sitting height. Doug, he says, what if I told you we had confirmation that Scott Burrows bedded Layla Mueller, the heiress, just hours before driving out to your home?
Well, I mean...
And that he is talking to her still, calling her from your home.
Doug feels his mouth go dry.
Okay, but does that mean... Do you think... Is he with my wife, or...
What do you think?
Doug closes his eyes. He's not equipped for this, for the feelings he's having. The sense that somehow in the last 2 weeks he has gone from winner to loser, as if his life is a practical joke the world is playing on him. In the studio, Bill reaches out and pats Doug's hand.
We'll be right back, he says.
Bullets. Who among us really understands how recording works? How an Edison machine in the old days laid grooves in a cylinder of vinyl, and from those grooves, when played back with a needle, came the exact replica of the sounds recorded, words or music. But how is that possible?
for a needle and a groove to recreate sound, for a scratch in a plastic wheel to capture the exact timbre of life. And then the change to digital, and how the human voice now passes through a microphone into a hard drive and somehow is codified into ones and zeros, translated to data, and then reassembled through wires and speakers to reconstruct the precise pitch and tone of human speech, the sounds of reggae or birds calling to each other on a summer day. It is just one of a million magic acts we have mastered over the centuries, technologies invented from anatomical stents to war machines, their origins traced back to the dirty days of the Neanderthal and the creation of fire, tools for survival and conquest, and how 10,000 years later, men in skinny jeans and Oliver Peoples eyeglasses can disassemble a black box inside a sterile case and probe it with wiry pentalobes and penlights. How they can replace damaged ports and run diagnostic software itself created from binary code. Each line simply a version of on or off. Gus Franklin sits on the back of his chair, feet on the seat. He has been awake for 36 hours, wearing yesterday's clothes, his face unshaved. They're close. That's what they tell him. Almost all of the data has been recovered. He'll have a printout any second. The flight recorder data detailing every move the plane made, every command entered. The voice recorder may take longer. Their ability to go back in time, the translation of ones and zeros into voices, hampering their ability to float inside that ghost cockpit and bear witness to the flight's final moments. Ballistics shows that the bullet holes are consistent with Gil Baruch's service weapon. Agent O'Brien, tired of looming over NTSB techs and asking how much longer, is in the city trying to find out more about the Bateman's body man. Because his body is missing, Agent O'Brien has floated a new theory. Maybe Gil turned on his employer, sold his services to another buyer, Al-Qaeda, the North Koreans, then, after the flight was underway, pulled his weapon and somehow crashed the plane, then escaped. Like a villain in a James Bond movie? Gus asked, to no response. He offered O'Brien the more likely theory that Baruch, whom they knew wasn't buckled in, was killed in the crash, his body thrown clear, swallowed by the deep or eaten by sharks. But O'Brien shook his head and said they needed to be thorough. On a parallel track, the autopsy results on Charles Bush came back about an hour ago. Toxicology was positive for alcohol and cocaine. Now there's an FBI team digging deeper into the co-pilot's history, interviewing friends and family, reviewing work history and school records. There's no evidence of any mental health issues in his files. Did he have a psychotic episode like the Germanwings co-pilot? Had Bush always been a time bomb and somehow managed to keep it secret? Gus stares at the art gallery on the far side of the hangar. A train derailed. A tornado approaching. He was a married man once, two toothbrushes in the medicine cabinet. Now he lives alone in a sterile apartment by the Hudson, hermetically sealed inside a glass cube. He owns one toothbrush, drinks from the same glass at every meal, rinsing it afterward and placing it on the rack to dry. A tech comes over carrying a clutch of papers, the printout. He hands it to Gus, who scans it. His team assembles around him, waiting. Somewhere the same information is being brought up on screen, a second group gathered around that. Everyone is looking for narrative, a story told in latitude and altitude, the literal rise and fall of Flight 613.
Cody, says Gus.
I see it, says Cody.
The data is pure numbers, vectors of thrust and lift. They're clean. They graph. To trace a journey mathematically, all you need are coordinates. Reading the data, Gus relives the final minutes of the airplane's journey. Data divorced from the lives and personalities of the passengers and crew. This is the story of an airplane, not the people on board. Engine performance records, flap specifics. Forgotten is the disaster scene around him, the art gallery and its patrons. The data shows that the flight takes off without incident, banking left, then straightening out,
the plane rising to 26,000 feet over a period of 6 minutes and 13 seconds, as ordered by ATC. At minute 6, the autopilot is switched on, and the flight heads southwest along a planned route. 9 minutes later, control of the plane is switched from pilot to co-pilot, Melody to Bush, for reasons the data can't project. Course and altitude remain constant. Then 16 minutes into the flight, the autopilot is turned off. The plane banks sharply and dives, what started as a slow port turn becoming a steep spiral, like a mad dog chasing its tail. All systems were normal. There was no mechanical error. The co-pilot turned off the autopilot and took manual control. He put the plane into a dive, ultimately crashing into the sea. Those are the facts. Now they know the root cause. What they don't know is A, why, and B, what happened next. They know Bush was drunk, high. Was his perception or judgment altered by drugs? Did he think he was flying the plane normally, or did he know he had begun a death spiral? More important, did the co-pilot wait for the pilot to go and then deliberately crash the plane? But why would he do that? What possible grounds would lie behind such an action? Gus sits for a moment. Around him there is a sudden rush of activity, numbers fed into algorithms, double-checked. But Gus is still. He knows for certain now. The crash was no accident. Its origins lie not in the science of tensile strength or joint wear, caused not by computer failure or faulty hydraulics, but in the murky whys of psychology, in the torment and tragedy of the human soul. Why would a handsome, healthy young man put a passenger plane into a steep and irrevocable dive, ignoring the panicked pounding of the captain outside the cockpit and his own shrieking survival instinct? What sort of unsteady foundation had taken root in the gray matter of his brain? What previously undiagnosed mental illness or recent deafening gripe at the injustices of the world could inspire a senator's nephew to kill 9 people, including himself, by turning a luxury jet into a missile? And can they conclude, then, that the shots fired were an attempt to re-enter the cockpit and take control of the plane? The solution to this mystery, in other words, lies outside the purview of engineers and in the realm of voodoo speculation. All Gus Franklin can do is grit his teeth and wade into the storm. He reaches for the phone, then thinks better of it. News like this, in the aftermath of multiple leaks, is best delivered in person. So he grabs his jacket and heads for the car.
"I'm heading in," he tells his team. "Call me when the techs crack the recorder."
Games. They are playing chutes and ladders in the living room when the call comes. Doug is on TV. Eleanor comes back from the kitchen, phone shaking. She meets Scott's eye, pantomimes that they need a way to keep the boy busy so they can talk.
"Hey, buddy," Scott tells him. "Go grab my bag from upstairs, huh? I got a present for you."
The boy runs upstairs, hair flying behind him, footsteps a sloppy cascade on the stairs. Eleanor watches him go, then turns, her face pale.
"What's wrong?" Scott asks.
"My mother," she says, looking for the TV remote.
"What?"
She is pawing through the junk drawer below the TV.
"Where's the remote?"
He spies it on the coffee table, grabs it. She takes it, turns on the TV, pushes buttons. The black screen blinks on. A center star coming to life, becoming sound, birthing an elephant on a savanna looking for water. Eleanor flips channels, searching.
"I don't understand," Scott says.
He throws a glance at the stairs. Overhead, he can hear the boy's feet on the ceiling, the closet door opening in the guest room. Then there's a sharp intake of breath from Eleanor, and Scott turns back. On screen is a flanneled and bearded Doug, sitting across from the red-suspendered Bill Cunningham. They are on a newsroom set behind an anchor desk. It is a surreal sight, as if 2 different programs have been spliced together side by side. A show about money and a show about trees.
Doug's voice fills the room mid-sentence. He is talking about Scott and how Eleanor threw her own husband out of the house, and maybe Scott is in it for the money. And Bill Cunningham is nodding and interrupting and restating Doug's points, at one point even stepping in to tell the story himself. A washed-up painter who beds married women and glorifies disaster scenes. Scott looks at Eleanor, who is clutching the remote to her chest, her knuckles white. For some reason, he thinks of his sister lying in her coffin, a 16-year-old girl who drowned on a late September day, swallowed by the murky deep, air bubbles rising. A virginal body that had to be dried and cleaned, muscled into its best dress by a 46-year-old mortician, a stranger who coated her skin with blush and brushed her waterlogged hair until it shone. And how her hands were raised to her chest, a spray of yellow daisies laced between her unfeeling fingers. And how his sister was allergic to daisies, which upset Scott to no end, until he realized that it didn't matter anymore.
"I don't understand,"
Eleanor says, then repeats it, more quietly this time, to herself, a mantra. Scott hears footsteps on the stairs and turns. He intercepts the boy as he spills down the stairs carrying Scott's bag, a confused, potentially hurt look on his face, as if to say, "I can't find the present." Scott approaches him at a raking angle, mussing his hair and detouring him smoothly into the kitchen. "Couldn't find it?" he says, and the boy shakes his head. "Okay," says Scott. "Let me look." He sits the boy at the kitchen table. Outside, a mail truck pulls up to the driveway. The mail carrier wears an old-school pith helmet. Past him, Scott can see the raised dishes of the news trucks parked at the end of the cul-de-sac waiting, watching. The mailman opens the mailbox, puts in a supermarket circular and some bills, oblivious to the drama inside. From the living room, Scott hears Doug say, "We were fine before he showed up. Happy." Scott digs through his bag, looking for something he can claim is a present. He finds the fountain pen his father gave him when he left for college, a black Mont Blanc. It is the one thing Scott has kept through the years, his fortunes rising and falling, the one constant as he fumbled his way through spells of drinking, through his great painter phases, kamikazing into periods of abject terror, numbing himself with booze, zeroing in on failure. And then through his rise from whatever ashes were left to a new body of work, a fresh start. Through his lowest point when he threw all his furniture out the window, every plate and dish, everything he owned, except the pen. He signs his paintings with this pen. "Here," he tells the boy, pulling it out of his bag. The boy smiles. Scott unscrews the cap, shows the boy how it works, uses it to draw a dog on a paper napkin. "My father gave it to me when I was young," he says, then realizes the implication that he is now passing the pen on to his own son, that he has adopted the boy somehow. He has the thought and pushes through it. Life can paralyze us, freeze us into statues if we think about things too long. He hands the pen to the boy, arguably the last piece of the man he once was, his spine, the only thing about him that has stayed straight and true, unfailing, reliable. He was a boy once himself, an explorer setting out for undiscovered lands. Not a single cell of that boy remains now. Scott's body changed at the genetic level, every electron and neutron replaced over the decades by new cells, new ideas. A new man. The boy takes the pen, tries it on the napkin, but can't get a line. "It's," says Scott, "it's a fountain pen, so you have to hold it." He takes the boy's hand, shows him how to hold it. From the kitchen, he hears Bill Cunningham say, "So, first he befriends the sister, a wealthy woman, and now that she's dead and the money has passed to her son, suddenly he's in your house and you're sleeping in an old truck." The boy gets a black line out of the pen, draws another. He makes a happy sound. Watching him, something inside Scott snaps into place. A sense of purpose. A decision he didn't even know he was making. He walks to the phone like a man on hot coals, determined not to look down. He dials information, gets the number for ALC, then asks for Bill Cunningham's office. After a few misdirects, he finds his way to Krista Brewer, Bill's producer.
"Mr. Burroughs?"
she says, sounding breathless, as if she has run a great distance to reach the phone. Because of the nature of time, the next moment is both endless and instantaneous. "Tell him I accept," says Scott.
"Pardon?"
"The interview. I'll do it."
"Wow! Great! Should we... I know we have a news truck nearby. Do you want to..."
"No. Stay away from the house. From the boy. This is between me and the gargoyle. A conversation about how maybe bullying and belittling people from a distance is a bullshit coward's way to be a man." The quality of her voice in the next moment can only be described as elated.
"Can I quote you on that?"
Scott thinks of his sister, her hands crossed, eyes closed. He thinks of the waves, towering, and the struggle to stay afloat, one arm dislocated. "No," he says. "I'll see you this afternoon." Painting number 5. "We are sorry for your loss." Footnote. White letters on black canvas. End footnote. The History of Violence. Gus is on 2nd Avenue headed back to the hangar when the call comes.
"Are you following this?" Mayberry asks.
"Following what?" he says. He has been lost in thought, ruminating about his meeting with the State Attorney General and heads of the FBI and the OFAC. The co-pilot was high. He crashed the plane deliberately.
"It's turned into a real soap opera," Mayberry says. "Doug, the uncle, went on TV to say he'd been thrown out of the house and that Burroughs had moved in. And now they're saying Burroughs is headed into the studio for an interview."
"Jesus," says Gus.
He thinks about calling Scott to warn him off, but then remembers that the painter has no cell phone.
Gus slows for a red light, a taxi merging, signalless in front of him, forcing him to slam on the brakes.
"Where are we on the flight recorder?" he asks.
"Close," says Mayberry. 10 minutes, maybe."
Gus joins a line of traffic headed for the 59th Street Bridge.
"Call me the second you have it," he says. "I'm on my way back."
60 miles north, a white rental car threads its way through Westchester toward the city. It's greener here, the parkway surrounded by trees. Unlike Gus's route, the road here is mostly empty. Scott changes lanes without signaling. He tries to exist solely in the moment he's living, a man driving a car on an Indian summer day. 3 weeks ago, he was a speck of dust in a raging sea. A year before that, he was a hopeless drunk waking on a famous painter's living room rug, staggering out into the harsh sunlight and discovering an aquamarine swimming pool. Life is made of these moments, of one's physical being moving through time and space. We string them together into a story, and that story becomes our life. So as he is sitting in his rented Camry on the Henry Hudson Parkway, he is also sliding into a chair in Studio 3 of the ALC building an hour later, watching a young man with glasses hide a wire microphone under Bill Cunningham's lapel. And, simultaneously, he is a teenager home from college, sitting on a 10-speed Schwinn beside a country road at night, waiting for his younger sister to finish her swim in Lake Michigan. Because what if instead of a story told in consecutive order, life is a cacophony of moments we never leave? What if the most traumatic or the most beautiful experiences we have trap us in a kind of feedback loop, where at least some part of our minds remains obsessed, even as our bodies move on? A man in a car, and on a bike, and in a television studio. But also in the front yard of Eleanor's house 30 minutes earlier, walking to the car, and Eleanor is asking him not to go, telling him that he's making a mistake.
"If you want to tell your story," she says, "fine. Call CNN. Call the New York Times. Not him.
Not Cunningham. In the ocean, Scott grabs the boy and dives beneath a wave too big to comprehend. And at the same time, he slows behind a dented station wagon, then puts on his turn signal and changes lanes. In the dressing room, Scott watches Bill Cunningham grimace, hearing him roll his R's and execute a succession of quick voice exercises, trying to decide if the feeling in his stomach is fear or dread or the thrill of the boxer before a fight he thinks he can win.
"Will you come back?" Eleanor asked him in the driveway.
And Scott looked at her, the boy on the porch behind her, eyes confused, and he said, "Is there a pool around here? I think I should teach the boy to swim." And how Eleanor smiled and said,
"Yes,
there was." In the hair and makeup room, Scott waited for Bill. It would be wrong to say he was nervous. What was the threat of one man after he had faced down the entire ocean? So Scott simply closed his eyes and waited to be called. "First of all," says Bill when they're across from each other and the cameras are rolling, "I want to thank you for sitting down with me today." The words are kind, but Bill's eyes are hostile, so Scott doesn't respond. "It's been a long 3 weeks," says Bill. I'm not sure how much any of us has slept. On the air, me personally, more than 100 hours on the hunt for answers. For the truth. "Am I supposed to look at you or the camera?" Scott interrupts. "At me. It's like any other conversation." "Well," says Scott, "I've had a lot of conversations in my life. None of them was like this." "I'm not saying the content," says Bill. "I'm talking about two men talking. Except this is an interview. A damn interview isn't a conversation." Bill leans forward in his chair. "You seem nervous."
"Do I?
I don't feel nervous. I just want to be clear on the rules."
"What do you feel then, if not nervous? I want viewers at home to be able to read your face."
Scott thinks about this. "It's strange," he says. "You hear the word sleepwalking sometimes. Now, some people sleepwalk through life and then something wakes them up. I don't. That's not how I feel. Maybe the opposite."
He watches Bill's eyes.
It's clear Bill doesn't know yet what to make of Scott, how to trap him. "The whole thing feels like some kind of dream," says Scott. He too is striving for truth. Or maybe he alone. "Like, maybe I fell asleep on the plane and I'm still waiting to wake up."
"Unreal, you're saying," says Bill.
Scott thinks about that. "No, it's very real. Too real, maybe. The way people treat each other these days. Not that I thought we lived on planet hugs, but..."
Bill sits forward, not interested in a conversation about manners.
"I'd like to talk about how you came to be on that plane."
"I was invited."
"By who?"
"Maggie."
"Mrs. Bateman?"
"Yes.
She said call her Maggie, so I call her Maggie. We met on the vineyard last summer. June, maybe. We went to the same coffee shop, and I'd see her at the farmer's market with JJ and her daughter."
"She came to your studio?"
"Once. I work out back of my house in an old barn. There were workmen in her kitchen, she said, and she needed something to do for the afternoon. The kids were with her."
"You're saying the only time you saw her outside of the market or a coffee shop, the kids were with her?"
"Yes."
Bill makes a face to indicate maybe he thinks that's bullshit.
"Some of your work could be considered pretty disturbing, don't you think?" he says.
"For children, you mean?" says Scott.
"I suppose.
But the boy was napping and Rachel wanted to see."
"So you let her?"
"No. Her mother. It wasn't my... And it's not like... For the record, the pictures aren't graphic. It's just an attempt."
"What does that mean?"
Scott thinks about that, what he's trying to say.
"What is this world?" he says. "Why do things happen? Does it mean something? That's all I'm doing, trying to understand." So I showed them around, Maggie and Rachel, and we talked.
Bill sneers. Scott can tell that the last thing he wants to do is talk about art.
In the cacophony of time, he is sitting in a television studio, but part of him is still in his car driving into the city, the wet roads smeared with the red trails of taillights, and he is also somehow sitting on the plane, trying to get oriented, a man who minutes earlier had been running from the bus stop.
"You had feelings for her, though," says Bill. "Mrs. Bateman."
What does that mean, feelings? She was a nice person. She loved her children.
But not her husband.
I don't know. It seemed that way. I've never been married, so what do I know? It's not something we ever... She was very comfortable, it seemed, as a person. They had fun, her and the kids. They laughed all the time. He worked a lot, it seemed, David, but they were always talking about him, the things they'd do when Daddy got there. He thinks for a moment. She seemed happy.
Gus is on the Long Island Expressway when the call comes. The flight recorder is fixed. There is some degradation, they tell him, but it's in the quality of sound, not the content of the recording. His team is about to listen back, and does Gus want them to wait for him?
No, he says. We need to know. Just put the phone up to the speaker.
They hurry to comply. He sits in his brown government vehicle in stop-and-go traffic. He is mid-island, past LaGuardia, not yet to Kennedy. Through the car's speakers, he can hear hurried activity as they prepare to review the tape. It is a record of another time, like a jar that holds the last breath of a dying man. The actions and voices of the tape are secret still, but in moments they will be out. The last unknown thing will become known. And then everything that can be clear will be clear. Any other mysteries are there for the ages. Gus breathes recycled air. Rain dots his windshield. The tape begins. It starts with two voices from within the cockpit. The captain, James Melody, has a British accent. Charles Bush, the co-pilot, has a Texas drawl.
"Checklist. Brakes?" says Melody.
"Are checked," responds Bush after a moment.
"Flaps?"
10-10, green.
"Yaw damper?"
"Checked."
"Little crosswind here," says Melody. "Let's keep that in mind."
"Flight instrument and annunciator panels?"
Yeah. No warnings."
"Okay, then. Checklist complete."
Traffic lightens ahead of Gus. He gets the Ford up to 26 miles per hour, then slows again as the line of cars ahead of him constricts. He would pull over to the side of the road and listen, except he's in the center lane with no exits in sight. The next voice is Melody's.
"Vineyard Flight Control, this is Gullwing 613. Ready for takeoff?"
A pause, and then a filtered voice comes through their radio.
"Gullwing 613, cleared for takeoff."
"Thrust, SRS. Runway?"
Melody tells Bush.
He hears mechanical sounds from the tape. The phone relay makes them hard to identify, but he knows that techs in the lab are already making guesses about which ones are yoke movement and which are increases in engine RPM.
80 knots, Bush.
More sounds from the tape as the plane leaves the ground.
"Positive rate," says Melody.
"Gear up, please."
ATC comes over their radio.
"Gullwing 613, I see you. Turn left, fly the bridge. Climb. Contact Teterboro departure. Good night."
"Gullwing 613, thanks much," says Melody.
"Gear up," says Bush.
The plane is in the air now, on its way to New Jersey. Under normal conditions, it is a 29-minute flight, less than a short hop. There will be a 6-minute lull before they are in range of Teterboro ATC. A knock.
"Captain?"
A female voice comes in. The flight attendant, Emma Leitner.
"Can I bring you anything?"
"No," says Melody.
"What about me?"
asks the co-pilot.
A pause. What was happening? What looks were being exchanged?
"He's fine," says Melody. "It's a short flight. Let's stay focused."
Bill Cunningham leans forward in his seat. They are on a set designed to be seen from a single direction. This means that the walls behind him are unpainted on the backside, like a set built for an episode of Twilight Zone
where an injured man slowly realizes that what he thinks is real is actually theater.
"And on the flight," says Bill. "Describe what happened."
Scott nods. He doesn't know why, but he's surprised that the interview is unfolding in this way, as an actual interview about the crash. What happened? He assumed they'd be trading body blows by now.
"Well," he says, "I was late. The cab never came, so I had to take the bus. Until we reached the runway, I assumed I'd missed it, that I'd get there just in time to see the taillights lifting off into the sky. But I didn't. They waited. Or not waited. They were folding in the door when I... But they didn't leave. So I got on. And everyone was already... Some people were in their seats. Maggie and the kids, Mrs. Kipling. David and Mr. Kipling were still on their feet, I think. And the flight attendant gave me a glass of wine. I'd never been on a private jet before. And then the captain said, 'Take your seats,' so we did."
His eyes have moved off Bill's by now, and he finds himself staring directly into one of the lights, remembering.
"There was a baseball game on. Boston. It was the seventh inning, I think. And the sound of that, the announcer's voice, was going the whole time. And I remember Mrs. Kipling was next to me, and we were talking a little. And the boy, JJ, was asleep. Rachel was on her iPhone, maybe choosing songs. She had headphones on. And then we were up."
Gus snails past LaGuardia, incoming and outgoing flights roaring past overhead. He has the windows up and the air off so he can hear better, even though it's 90 degrees out. He sweats as he listens, tendrils running down his sides and back, but he doesn't notice. He hears James Melody's voice. "I've got a yellow light." A pause. Gus can hear what sounds like tapping. Then Melody again.
"Did you hear me? I've got a yellow light."
"Oh," says Bush. "Let me... That's got it. I think it's the bulb."
"Make a note for maintenance," says Melody.
Then a series of unidentifiable sounds, and then Melody exclaims,
"Merde. Hold on, I've got a..."
"Captain?"
"Take over. Got a goddamn nosebleed again. I'm gonna... Let me get cleaned up."
Sounds from the cockpit that Gus assumes are the captain getting up and going to the door. As this happens, Bush says,
"Copy. Taking control."
The door opens and closes. And now Bush is alone in the cockpit. Scott listens to the sound of his own voice as he speaks, both in the moment and outside of it.
"And I was looking out the window and thinking the whole time how unreal it felt. The way you sometimes feel like a stranger when you find yourself outside the limits of your experience, doing something that feels like the actions of another person, as if you've teleported somehow into someone else's life."
"And what was the first sign that something was wrong," says Bill, "in your mind?" Scott takes a breath, trying to make logical sense of it all. It's hard because there was cheering, and then there was screaming.
"Cheering?"
"For the game. It was David and Kipling. They were... Something was happening on screen that had them dworkin' and the longest at bat. And their seat belts were off by that point, and I remember they both stood up, and then, I don't know, the plane dropped, and they had to scramble to get back in their seats."
"And you said before in your interview with investigators that your seat belt was off."
"Yeah, that was... It was stupid, really. I had a notebook, a sketchbook, and when the plane pitched down, my pencil flew out of my hands, and I unbuckled and went after it."
"Which saved your life."
"Yeah, I guess that's true. But in the moment, people were screaming, and there was this banging. And then..." Scott shrugs, as if to say, "That's all I really remember."
Across from him, Bill nods. "So, that's your story," he says.
"My story?"
"Your version of events."
"That's my memory."
"You dropped your pencil and unbuckled to grab it, and that's why you survived."
"I have no idea why I survived, if that's even..."
if there is a why, and not just, you know, the laws of physics.
Physics?
Yes. You know, physical forces that picked me up and threw me from the plane and somehow let the boys survive, but not, you know, anyone else.
Bill pauses as if to say, I could go deeper, but I'm choosing not to. Let's talk about your paintings.
There is a moment in every horror movie that hinges on silence. A character leaves a room, and rather than go with him, the camera remains in place, focused on nothing, an innocuous doorway perhaps, or a child's bed. The viewer sits and watches the empty space, listening to the silence, and the very fact that the room is empty and the fact that it is silent convey a dawning sense of dread. Why are we here, waiting? What's going to happen? What will we see? And so, with a creeping fear, we begin to search the room for something unusual, to strain against the silence for whatever whispers live beneath the ordinary. It is the room's very unremarkableness that adds to its potential for horror, what Sigmund Freud called the uncanny. True horror, you see, comes not from the savagery of the unexpected, but from the corruption of everyday objects, spaces. To take a thing we see every day, a thing we take for granted as normal, a child's bedroom, and transform it into something sinister, untrustworthy, is to undermine the very fabric of life. And so we stare into the normal, the camera motionless, unwavering. And in the tension of that unblinking stare, our imagination produces a feeling of fear that has no logical explanation. It is this feeling that comes over Gus Franklin as he sits in his car on the LIE, surrounded by commuters on their way to points east, men driving home from work, families heading home from school or to the beach for a late afternoon adventure. The silence in his car has a crackle to it, a hiss that fills the recycled air. It is machine noise, impenetrable, but unignorable. Gus reaches over and turns up the volume, the hiss becoming deafening. And then he hears whispering, a single word whispered over and over again. Bitch.
Let's not talk about my paintings, says Scott.
Why? What are you hiding?
I'm not... They're paintings. By definition, everything relevant about them is there for the eye to see.
Except you're keeping them secret.
The fact that I haven't shown them yet is not the same as me keeping them secret. The FBI has them now. I have slides at home. A few people have seen them, people I trust. But the truth is, my paintings are literally irrelevant.
Let me get this straight. A man who paints disaster scenes, literal plane crashes, is in a plane crash, and we're supposed to think, what, that it's just a coincidence?
I don't know. The universe is filled with things that don't make sense. Random coincidences. There's a statistical model somewhere that could work out the odds of me being in a plane crash or a ferry accident or a train derailment. These things happen every day, and none of us is immune. Maybe my number came up is all.
I spoke to an art dealer, says Bill, who said your work is now worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Nothing's been sold. That's theoretical money. Last time I checked, I had $600 in the bank.
Is that why you moved in with Eleanor and her nephew?
Is what why I moved in with Eleanor and her nephew?
Money. The fact that the boy is now worth close to $100 million.
Scott looks at him.
Is that a real question? He says, you bet your ass. First of all, I haven't moved in. That's not what the woman's husband told me. In fact, she threw him out of the house.
Just because two things happen in sequence doesn't mean there's a causal relationship.
I didn't go to an Ivy League school, so you're going to have to explain that one.
I'm saying the fact that Eleanor and Doug have separated, if that's what happened, has nothing to do with the fact that I came to visit.
Bill pulls himself up to his full height. Let me tell you what I see, he says. I see a failed painter, a drunk, who's floating along 10 years past his prime, and then life hands him an opportunity.
A plane crashed. people are dead. He finds himself in the spotlight, a hero, and suddenly everyone wants